keep everyone going in the right direction? The answer is the third role of leadership, aligning. That is, designing and executing systems and structures that reinforce the core values and the highest strategic priorities of the organization, which were selected in the pathfinding process. Consider the current structures, systems, and processes in your organization. Do they enable people to execute top priorities, or do they create roadblocks in doing so? Are they consistent with the organization's espoused values? It is the responsibility of leadership to remove obstacles, not create them. Yet the process of alignment requires a deep and humble examination of self and many sacred cow organizational systems and structures. New heading, organizational trustworthiness. As mentioned earlier, the organization is the second major source of trust, the first being the individual. When trustworthy people work within structures and systems that are not aligned with the organization's espoused values, the untrustworthy systems will dominate every time. You simply won't have trust. Through tradition and cultural expectations, these systems and processes become so deeply embedded in the organization, so congealed, that they are far more difficult to change than individual behavior. In fact, our XQ data confirm that there is a serious trust gap within organizations. Only 48% of respondents agree that their organizations generally live up to the values of the organization. For instance, almost all organizations espouse the importance of teamwork and cooperation, but they also have deeply embedded systems that reward internal competition. I once worked with a company that had no spirit of cooperation. The CEO couldn't understand why his people wouldn't cooperate. He had preached it, trained for it, psyched people up about it, but still no cooperation. While we were talking, I happened to glance up behind the CEO's desk and saw a curtain that had accidentally been left open. Behind the desk was a mock horse race. Lined up on the left-hand side were all of the horses. An oval picture of each manager's face was pasted on the front of each horse. On the right side hung a travel poster of Bermuda showing a romantic couple walking hand in hand on a white sandy beach. Now imagine the misalignment here. "Come on," he would say. "Let's work together. Let's cooperate. You'll make more. You'll do better. You'll be happier. You'll enjoy it more. The company's future will be assured." Then he would pull the curtain and say, "Which one of you is going to win the trip to Bermuda?" He again asked me, "Why won't they cooperate?" Systems will override words or rhetoric every day of the week. One of the great insights of Edward Deming was that over 90% of all organizational problems are systemic. The problems arise because of systems or structures. They're not what he called special caused or people caused. However, in the last analysis, and he knew this, since people are the programmers and systems are the programs, people are ultimately responsible for those systems. Systems and structures are things, they are programs, they have no freedom to choose, so the leadership still comes from people. People design systems, and all organizations get the results they are designed and aligned to get. Many honest people are incompetent when it comes to designing organizational systems. And likewise, some competent people are dishonest and duplicitous. But organizational trustworthiness requires both organizational character and organizational competence. Simply put, alignment is institutionalized trustworthiness. This means that the very principles that people have built into their value system are the basis for designing structures, systems, and processes. Even if the environment, market conditions, and people change, the principles do not. It is described well in the language of the architect. Form follows function. In other words, structure follows purpose. Alignment follows pathfinding. Discipline is manifest both personally and organizationally. In the organizational context, discipline is called aligning, because you're creating or aligning your structures, systems, processes, and culture to enable the vision to be realized. So we have to be aware of what we could call synergistic decision-making and stovepipe execution. If the value system focuses on the long-term as well as the short-term, then the information system should focus on both long and short-term. If the value system holds cooperation and synergy supreme, then the compensation system should reward cooperation and synergy. This doesn't mean that individual effort and performance should not be recognized and rewarded also. For instance, the size of a compensation pie may be based upon cooperation and synergy, but a particular individual's piece of that pie would be based upon individual effort within the complementary team, thus nurturing both interdependence and independence. Many organizations fall into the trap of rewarding only individual effort at the expense of cooperative effort. Little more than lip service, the value of cooperation is not built into their recognition and reward system. Since everybody is operating on their own agenda, people go along with compensation systems that reward individual effort. Even if serving the customer at the optimal level requires teamwork, that teamwork will not happen, and the result will be failure in the marketplace. It's not that people do not want to cooperate. It's that the system rewards individual effort, and sometimes even internal competition. Again, remember that systems will override and overwhelm rhetoric or good intentions at the end of the day. New heading. Didn't you hire all these people to be winners? I came across another commonly misaligned system while speaking to a group of about 800 at their annual convention. In their system, only 30 of the 800 received rewards. 30 of 800. I turned to the president and said, "Didn't you hire all of these people to be winners?" "Yes." "Did you hire any losers?" "No." "You have 770 losers tonight." "Well, they didn't win the contest." "They're losers." "Why?" "Because of the way you're thinking. It's win-lose. What else could you do?" "Make them all winners." "Where do you get the concept that you have to have contests? Where do you get the idea that winning means to beat? Don't you have enough competition in the marketplace?" "Well, that's just the way life is." "Really? How's your relationship with your wife? Who's winning there?" "Well, some days she wins, some days I win." I said, "Is that the kind of modeling you want to give to your kids for their futures? Come on." He responded, "Well, how do I do it with compensation?" I said, "It's not that difficult. Set up an individualized win-win performance agreement with every person and every team. If they accomplish the desired results, they win." 1 year later, I was invited back after a lot of pathfinding and aligning work had been done. This time, over 1,000 people were at the annual rally. And of the 1,000, guess how many won? 800. The 200 who didn't chose not to. It was their choice. There was no comparison at all. They simply hadn't accomplished their win-win performance agreement. And what did those 800 people produce? They produced as much business as the previous year's 30 per person. The whole culture had changed. The whole culture had moved from scarcity thinking to abundance thinking. 800 people were where last year's 30 were. Why? Let's answer the question by contrasting this story with the earlier Bermuda story. Instead of each one thinking, "Which one of us is going to Bermuda?" each would be thinking, "I want you to go to Bermuda with your spouse and with me. I want all of us to go. I want you to go to Bermuda with your spouse and with me and my spouse. I want all of us to go. I'm pulling for you." Imagine how that thought process could revolutionize an internally competitive organization. But you know, in both cases, the presidents were not untrustworthy men. They had the character, even an abundance mentality. They just didn't have the mindset or the skill set to create aligned compensation systems. They didn't have complete information systems. It's analogous to flying an airplane with only one dial working. It's disastrous. But they grasped the concept right away. Again, the problem wasn't character. Their problem was competency. They had never learned the skill. And they'd been caught in a scarcity-minded, traditional, duplicitous system that would remain duplicitous until they acquired the skills. New heading. Aligning requires constant vigilance. Aligning work is never finished. It requires constant effort and adjustment simply because you're dealing with so many changing realities. Systems, structures, and processes must remain flexible so that they can adjust to these changing realities. Yet they must also be based upon unchanging principles. With this combination of flexible changelessness, you create an organization that is both stable and agile. You see, principles represent the deeper well. The deeper well of principles supplies all of the shallower wells and root structures of empowerment, quality, producing more for less, sustainability, scalability, and agility. One way to lubricate your organization's ability to make the constant and necessary alignment changes is again to be serious about benchmarking against superior performers of similar functions within your own organization and in all industries or professions throughout the world. This gets people involved in and coming up with world-class awareness and definitions instead of just looking to the past or extrapolating from trends in either their own industry or with their current competitors. You look for best practice organizations that are reputed to be superior performers. Not that they are perfect or will even remain superior, but look constantly for today's best and to learn from them, from world-class. Observation, common sense, and solid research have shown that successful organizations are not a product of solo acts of people or of the individual traits of formal leaders. Successful organizations are a product of the organizational trait. They are not personality dependent. They are system and culture dependent. We'll discuss culture in greater depth when we move into the empowering role. General Electric is one illustration of a company that in many of its divisions made the transition from the industrial to the knowledge worker age. The primary focus of the longtime CEO Jack Welch and Dr. Noel Tishy, who served as GE's Manager of Management Education, was to embed leadership development in GE's genes and in training its leaders. Here's the way Dr. Tishy put it. Mr. Welch's insight, which was not widely shared in business at the time, was that leadership was not the province solely of the CEO in his or her senior executive team, but had to be institutionalized throughout the company. A globalizing economy meant that a business world long characterized by stability, autocracy, and strictly bounded processes would have to become more change-embracing, which would require the development of nimble, adaptable leaders up and down the company's hierarchies. This in turn meant building the capacity for teaching men and women not only how to manage change, but how to create it. New heading. Institutionalized moral authority. Aligned organizations and institutions that are truly principle-centered have institutionalized moral authority. Institutionalized moral authority is the institutional capacity to consistently produce quality, trusting relationships with various stakeholders, and continued focus upon efficiency, speed, flexibility, and market friendliness. Certain individuals may blow it from time to time, but the institution handles them appropriately and moves on. We see institutionalized moral authority all the time in countries that have culturally sustained constitutions, written or unwritten. Individual leaders may not always act consistently with their constitutions, but these countries are able to build on the strengths of the individual leaders and rely on the rest of government to essentially make these leaders' weaknesses irrelevant. This wouldn't be the case with dictatorships or with tender, newly developing democracies that are still filled with codependent and culturally endorsed corruption. Admittedly, corrupt, dictatorial, or ego-driven leaders can do a lot of damage for a period of time, even when there's a great deal of institutionalized moral authority. But usually the organization or institution bounces back. Fundamentally, the power is in the system, not in the elected officials or appointed bureaucrats. The system is stronger than the individual weaknesses of the participants. This is why the Marriott Corporation teaches that the devil lies in the details, but success lies in the systems. I visited recently with J.W. Bill Marriott, chairman and CEO of Marriott International, the world's largest hotel operator. Bill and his father before him created one of the finest organizations in the world, and they've done it in part by creating a communication system that taps into the genius of their people. "The biggest lesson I've learned through the years is to listen to your people," he told me. "I find that if you have senior managers who really gather their people around them, then if you sit around a table with those managers and listen to their input, you make a lot better decisions." His appreciation of that lesson came early in life. He told me of an encounter with one of the world's most renowned leaders, President Dwight David Eisenhower. He put it this way: "I was finishing up college and had been in the Navy for 6 months and had come home from the Supply Corps school for Christmas. And the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Ezra Taft Benson, came down to our farm with General Eisenhower. Eisenhower was president, and I was an ensign in the Navy. It was colder than blazes outside," Marriott said, "but my dad had put these targets up for shooting. He asked President Eisenhower, 'Do you want to go out and shoot or stay by the fire?' He turned around to me and asked, 'What do you think, Ensign?' Even the day telling me the story, Marriott seemed stunned. I said to myself, 'You know, that's how he's got by dealing with De Gaulle, Churchill, Marshall, Roosevelt, Stalin, Montgomery, Bradley, and Patton. He asked that golden question, "What do you think?" So I said, 'Mr. President, it's too cold out there. Stay inside by the fire.'" To this day, Marriott said, that lesson has stayed with him. "It was a real defining moment for me," he told me. "I remember thinking afterwards, if I ever get into business, I'm going to ask that question. And if I do, I'll bet I get some pretty good information." Close quote. That's why Bill Marriott has structured his hotel chain the way he has, creating a culture that encourages communication both up and down the line. He realizes that simply asking, "What do you think?" can turn even people who are considered manual workers into knowledge workers by listening to them and respecting their experience and wisdom. He summarized by saying, "My son John was working up in New York with the division of a company that we had acquired. While in the kitchen, he walked up to one of the people and said, 'We've got this problem out front. What do you think we should do?' Tears came to the eyes of this worker as he answered, 'I've worked with this old company for 20 years, and no one has ever asked me my opinion about anything.'" New heading: the aligning tool, the feedback systems. Three of the leadership roles and their tools deal with one basic question: what matters most? The third role, aligning, deals with the question, are we on target? Are we on track regarding what matters most? The truth is, as mentioned earlier, we're all off track most of the time. All of us, every individual, family, organization, or international flight to Rome. Just realizing this is a significant step. But for many of us, the feeling of being off track brings with it discouragement and despair. it needn't and shouldn't be so depressing. Knowing we're off track, even a little bit, is really an invitation to realign ourselves with true north, with principles, and recommit ourselves to our destination. Remember, our journey as an individual, team, or organization is like the flight of an airplane. Before the plane takes off, the pilots file a flight plan. They know exactly where they're going. But during the course of the flight, wind, rain, turbulence, air traffic, human error, and other factors act upon that plane. They move that plane slightly in different directions, so that most of the time it is not even on the prescribed flight path. But barring anything too major, the plane will still arrive at its destination. Now, how does that happen? During the flight, the pilots receive constant feedback. They receive information from instruments that read the environment, control towers and other airplanes, even sometimes from the stars. And based on that feedback, they make adjustments so that time and time again, they return to the original plan. The flight of that airplane is, I believe, the ideal metaphor for these four roles. Modeling, pathfinding, and empowering allow us to determine for our families, our organizations, our jobs, and ourselves what matters most, what we should focus upon. These are our flight plans. The constant feedback that we, like pilots, receive represents our opportunity to check our progress and realign ourselves with the original guiding criteria. Together, these roles and tools help us arrive at our envisioned destination. New heading: Achieving a balance between getting results and developing capability. The key to the principle of alignment is to always begin with the end in mind, with the desired results. What kind of results are you getting in the marketplace? Are your shareholders happy with the return on their investment? What about your employees? Are they happy with the return on their mental, physical, spiritual, and emotional investment? What about suppliers? What about the community? Do you have any sense of social responsibility toward the kids, toward the schools, toward the streets, toward the air and water, toward the context in which your employees work and raise their families? What about all these results from these stakeholders? What about the customers? How is it going? What are the results? How do you benchmark against world-class standards? You have to study and examine all these stakeholder results, and then examine the gap between those results and your strategy. You see, effectiveness is the balance between the production of desired results and production capability. In other words, it's the golden eggs that people want and the goose that lays them. Sometimes we call this the PPC balance, P for production of desired results, PC for production capability. The essence of effectiveness is achieving the results you want in a way that enables you to get even more of these results in the future. Over the last 10 years, there have been many approaches developed to measure the PPC balance. I have frequently taught the importance of 360-degree feedback, suggesting that the first 90 degrees represents financial accounting, and the remaining 270 degrees consists of scientifically gathered information on the perceptions of the organization's key stakeholders and the strength of their feelings around those perceptions. There are many names for this kind of feedback. One of the strongest recent movements calls it the balanced scorecard. Sometimes I have called this approach double bottom line accounting. Traditional accounting is always focused on the single bottom line, the golden eggs. Double bottom line accounting also shows respect for the goose, quantifying the health of the goose by summarizing the quality of the organization's relationship with all of its key stakeholders, customers, suppliers, associates and their families, government, community, environment, etc. You can imagine the power of having a two-page summary of the present and future health and strength of your organization, one page devoted to the financial statement, that is, the present fruits of prior efforts, and the other giving you a leading indicator of your relationships with the stakeholders, which will produce all your future results. The important thing is to come up with what we call a scoreboard, a compelling scoreboard. In fact, the people who are involved and who will be evaluated need to participate in establishing this compelling performance scoreboard so that it reflects the criteria built into the mission, values, and strategy of an organization so that they can continuously stay aligned with the process and be both responsible and accountable. They need to emotionally connect to it and to own it. This is also true of individuals, teams, departments, or any person who has responsibility to complete a task or handle a project. In short, everyone should be involved in developing the scoreboard and then be accountable to it. Additional practical application suggestions on creating a compelling scoreboard will be given in Chapter 14. By the way, you know what we found out? Hardly anyone measures progress on their most important goals. Only 10%, 1 in 10, of the XQ respondents report that they have a clear, accurate, visible scoreboard that provides genuine feedback. Actionable intelligence for frontline decision-making is the imperative in the knowledge economy. Let me illustrate the importance of this idea of the scoreboard feedback system by sharing an experience with you of an organization that came face to face with these diagnostic questions. Once I was speaking to a national association of newspaper publishers and editors at a large conference. To prepare for the event, I gathered data from cultural audits performed on various newspaper organizations. They indicated trust levels, commonality of purpose and values, systemic misalignment, and consequent disempowerment in the industry. Before presenting the data, I decided to try a different approach. Walking around the large hall with the microphone and asking the questions, what is the essential role of newspapers in society? What is your central purpose? As I handed the microphone to person after person, they unhesitatingly spoke of the absolutely vital role that newspaper organizations play in our society. They believe the deeper analysis in the print media keeps government honest and public officials accountable and visible to the public. A cumulative expression focused around serving the country and our communities by preserving our most basic values. Freedom, government being accountable to the people, the preservation of the checks and balances identified in the Constitution, and helping to inform people in order to preserve the ideals of our democratic republic and free enterprise system. Then, still walking around the audience, I shifted my questions to, do you really believe those purposes? Really? Do you feel them in your heart? As I walked around the room asking people to respond, the response was unanimously yes, yes. The next question was tougher. How do you know if a person really believes particular values? How do you know if a person really believes what he says that he values? As different answers came forth, I posited the idea that one of the tests would be that the person tries to live true to his or her values. I suggested that integrity toward values indicates real belief. They seemed to universally agree. Then I got to the key question. How many of your newspaper organizations possess some function that is similar to the function you provide to the community and the country? They were puzzled by my question, so I asked, how many of you have a function inside your own organizations or culture to keep people honest, accountable, and aligned with your most basic ideals and values? Only about 5% raised their hands. Then I shared with them the data that had been gathered from their cultural audits. I showed them the extreme levels of distrust, interpersonal conflict, interdepartmental rivalries, misalignment, and profound disempowerment of people. I then proceeded to share with them the idea of the four roles, of starting first with themselves, of beginning the process of involving others in clarifying purposes, then of setting up information and reinforcement and reward systems to create an optimum environment of empowerment. Many of these editors and publishers walked away from that event with a totally different paradigm of leadership. It was a very interesting and illuminating experience for all of us. The importance of this kind of feedback applies not only to an organization, but also to individuals within an organization. At one time, I did a training program for the commanding generals of an Air Force in a country with a history of challenge and conflict. I was talking about the importance of getting feedback from their key stakeholders, and I noticed that the generals were nodding their heads in agreement. I turned to the general in charge and said, "Does this mean you're using such a system of feedback and measurement?" He said, "Absolutely, that's the way we train these people. They're top pilots, not trained managers. So everyone gets an annual printout of the perceptions of all those they interface with and the strength of those perceptions. They use it as a basis for their personal and professional development. And no one gets promoted unless they have high marks, including from their subordinates." I said, "You have no idea how hard it is to get that concept brought into many organizations in my country. What keeps it from becoming a popularity contest?" Looking at me with disdain, he replied, "Stephen, the very survival of our country depends on these people, and they know it. Do you really think we would allow ourselves to enter into popularity contests? In fact, sometimes the most unpopular people among us are given the highest marks because they perform, consistently perform." Aligning structures and systems with values and strategy is one of the toughest of all leadership and management challenges, simply because structures and systems represent the past, tradition, expectations, and assumptions. Many people derive their security from the predictability and certainty of such structures and systems. They truly are sacred cows and cannot be ignored or kicked around unless there is deep buy-in and emotional connection to the strategic pathfinding criteria. Consider the following contrast between the structures and systems of the old industrial age control model with the new knowledge worker age release or empowerment model. While it is helpful to compare the two in contrast, the real world would put these more on a continuum than either or. At the very least, perhaps these contrasting lists shows the extreme ends of each continuum and may serve to highlight the enormous leverage of aligning cultures, structures, and systems with the pathfinding criteria. Regarding leadership, the industrial age control model focuses upon a position or formal authority. The new knowledge worker age or release and empowerment model focuses upon leadership becoming a choice, moral authority. Management under the old model, control things and people. Under the new model, control things, but release or empower people. Under structure, the old model is hierarchical and bureaucratic. The new model is flatter, boundaryless, and flexible. Under motivation, the old model is external, carrot and sticking. Under the new model, internal, because of the release of a whole person's needs, body, mind, heart, and spirit. Under performance appraisal, the old model is external, using the sandwich technique, or something like it. Under the new model, it's self-evaluation, using 360-degree feedback. Under information, the old model is primarily short-term and deals with financial reports. Under the new model, it's a balanced scoreboard, so that you look at both long and short-term, at P and PC. Under communication, the old model is primarily top-down. Under the new model, it's open, up, down, sideways. Culture under the old model is based on social rules, which focus upon the mores and norms of the workplace. Under the new model, it's principle-centered values and focuses upon the economic rules of the marketplace so that the norms are in harmony with the marketplace. Under budgeting, the old model is primarily top-down. The new model is open, flexible, and synergistic. Under training and development, the old model makes training and development a kind of sideshow, expendable, very skill-oriented. Under the new model, it's fundamental. It's under the main tent. It deals with the maintenance, with strategic, with the whole person, and with values. People under the old model are basically an expense on the P&L statement, and lip service is giving to people being our most important asset. Under the new model, people are an investment with the highest leverage on every other investment. Under the old model, voice is generally unimportant for most, except for maybe a few at the top. Under the new model, is strategic for all, so that a complementary team is formed. Now let's look at a film. This film is called Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall was up for over 40 years, over two generations. Imagine how deep the division between East and West became in the minds and hearts of the people. What a profound separation. What a profound contrast. When in 1989 it physically came down, it didn't necessarily come down in the hearts and minds of most of the people. It was like a sacred cow, like the old structures and systems of the industrial age. Tradition dies hard. I'll never forget a cab ride into East Berlin with no Berlin Wall, and hearing the cab driver complain about the feelings of insecurity he felt, adjusting to a freer market and a more democratic society. He preferred the security and stability that the old regime and wall represented. This was a shock to me to hear him talk this way. He said most of the old-timers feel that way and that they are critical of the new generation, who prefer greater freedom to security. So as you view this film, think of how truly difficult it is for people to develop a new mindset, a new paradigm, a new and different way of thinking, and then how it requires a new skill set and a new tool set. Think also of how futile it would be to teach people the new skills and tools with the old mindset. It would be like putting new wine in old bottles. Please insert the companion DVD into your DVD player and select Berlin Wall. We now move to the final and accumulating role of leadership. Empowering. But let's first deal with a few commonly asked questions about aligning. What if you're in the middle of an organization with systems that are so focused on the short-term internal competition and the force ranking systems and numbers that it has produced a culture that feeds upon itself? What realistically can you do in such a situation? My answer is, if such an organization is tied to the competitive forces of the marketplace, you can use your freedom of choice and trim tab yourself into a larger circle of influence. If it is not tied to the competitive forces of the marketplace, you may use the Greek philosophy, ethos, pathos, and logos, until others come to realize that their purposes will be better served by accepting your recommendations. Or if you have paid the price in personal and professional development on a continuous basis to the point where your security lies in your power to produce solutions to problems and to meet human needs, you will have endless opportunities to do other things. In such a case, you may do exactly that, choose to go elsewhere and do those other things. Another question. What is the most crucial activity of any management or leadership team, next to setting up the process of doing strategic pathfinding work? My answer, I would say recruiting, selecting, and positioning people. To use Jim Collins' language, to make sure that you have the right people in the right seats, and I would add, and on the right bus. I would even say that recruiting, selecting, and positioning are more important than training and development. You see, the problem is that most organizations in a fast-moving economy need people so fast and the problems are so pressing and urgent that they go into crisis hiring practices. Remember, that which you desire most earnestly, you believe most easily. So you grab people without any deep analysis that really look good. Then downstream, you often have to live with real disasters. Instead, you should do strategic hiring so that you have carefully thought about the criteria, communicated them, and paid the price to look in depth at the track record of different people. Pay the price to really build a relationship with possible candidates to the point that they are authentic and transparent and have the time to decide whether their own vision, value, and voice are truly in alignment with the strategic criteria of their future work. And involve other people in making such decisions. Counsel is fundamental in making such critical strategic choices. After all, the key is execution. Another question. In your experience, what is the best question to ask people when you hire them? My answer is simply to say this. Starting with your earliest memory, what did you really like doing that you did well? Then push that question through grade school, junior high, high school, university, and work assignments afterwards until you start to see a real pattern of where people's real talents and strengths are, where their real voice is. You will also see patterns of dependency, independency, or interdependency, and you will see patterns of working with things, with people, or simply working with ideas. You must also be willing to share the strategically developed criteria of the roles you expect people to play. Another question, what happens when codependency, you know, passivity and compliance, gets rewarded? My answer is, it will only be temporarily rewarded because the marketplace will slap it down. It cannot succeed in the long run because a passive, codependent person will not serve customers well with creativity, ingenuity, and anticipation. In the long run, if you have transparency in and good feedback from the marketplace, neither codependent people nor cultures can survive. Lean, empowered, nimble, creative, innovative cultures are what is needed in today's global economy, particularly if your competition is global, not local. Another question. What about the whole process of building a team? My answer. Team building is fundamental, particularly in developing complementary teams where people's strengths are made productive and their weaknesses are made irrelevant by the strengths of others, where the unifying force is a common vision and value system. But I'll tell you, it'll take a lot of aligned structures and systems to reinforce team building. If you say to one flower, grow, but you water another, the first one won't grow. If you say, let's work as a team, and then think independently and authoritatively, and make a lot of unilateral, arbitrary decisions, you won't build a team. Team building is an extremely important and desirable activity, if it is reinforced by team building principles inside the structures, systems, and processes of the organization. Otherwise, it will become a buzzword and sideshow, and will not come under the main tent. Another question. How do you get a united, cohesive culture when you have so many visions and goals throughout an entire organization? My answer is to induce pain. As long as people are contented and happy, they're not going to do much. You don't want to wait until the market induces pain so that you have to induce it in other ways. A balanced scoreboard approach does it, particularly if people have helped develop it and are accountable to it, and if rewards are based upon it. Chapter 13, the fourth and last role of leadership, is called empowering. So the title of this chapter 13 is The Empowering Voice, Releasing Passion and Talent. Harold Grenin, the former chairman of ITT, put it this way. The best way to inspire people to a superior performance is to convince them by everything you do and by your everyday attitude that you are wholeheartedly supporting them. The myth of empowering is called carrot and sticking, the great jackass theory, as being the best form of motivation and empowerment. That's the old paradigm. The new paradigm, carrot and stick motivation, is basically animal psychology. Because people have the power to choose. They are not things. You can buy someone's back, but you can't buy their heart and mind. You can buy their hands, but not their spirit. The new paradigm deals with the whole person, body, mind, heart, and spirit. The first alternative to the empowering role of leadership is trying to get results by controlling people. The second alternative would be to set them loose, to abandon them, to go into permissiveness. In other words, preach empowerment when in fact you're really into abdication and ignoring accountability. The third alternative is both tougher and kinder. You see, it's directed autonomy through win-win agreements around cascading line-of-sight goals and accountability for results. I mentioned earlier that I believe most organizations, including our homes, are overmanaged and underled. Because the friction in our relationships with our children is a painful reminder of this reality, as is the rebellion that often ensues, and because the family setting is so universal, I'm going to begin our discussion of the challenge of empowerment with the true story of a friend and partner of mine who, with his wife, worked to overcome a challenge with their children. This is his language. I noticed a dark cloud forming over my wife one day, so I asked her, "What's wrong?" "I'm so discouraged," she answered. "Mornings with the kids before school are awful. I feel that if I were not here telling them what to do next, nothing would ever happen. They'd never get to school. They'd never get ready. They'd never get out of bed. I don't know what to do." So I decided to observe the next morning. She went into each room starting at about 6:15, gave each child a gentle nudge and said, "Honey, it's time to get up. Wake up." She returned two or three times until they were all rousted out. Then she turned on the shower for the one who has the toughest time getting up. For the next 10 minutes, my wife returned to the shower repeatedly, tapped three other times on the glass door and said, "Time to get out." "I will," came the defensive answer. Our daughter finally turned off the shower, dried off, went to her room, curled up into a little ball on the floor, and covered her body with the towel to warm up. 10 minutes later, "Honey, you've got to get dressed. Come on." "I don't have anything to wear." "Wear this. I don't like those clothes. They're ugly." "What do you want to wear?" "My jeans, but they're dirty." The emotional scenario continued until all three were called downstairs at 6:45. My wife continued to prod the children from one thing to the next, warning that the carpool would be coming any minute. They finally got out the door with a hug and a kiss, and Mom was exhausted. I was exhausted just having watched her all morning. I thought, no wonder she's miserable. Those kids don't know they're capable of anything themselves because we're always there reminding them. That tapping on the shower door became a symbol of how we had both unintentionally enabled their irresponsibility. So I called the family together one evening and suggested a new approach. I've noticed that we're having quite a time with our mornings. Everyone started laughing knowingly. I said, "Who likes the way things are going?" No one raised a hand, so I said, "I want to tell you something that I want you to really think about. Here it is. You have within you the power to make choices. You can be responsible." Then I went through a whole series of questions. I asked, "How many of you can set an alarm clock yourself, then get up on your own each morning?" They all kind of looked at me like, "Dad, what are you doing?" I said, "No, really, how many of you can do this?" Each raised a hand. "How many of you can be aware enough of the time that you can remember how long you have to shower and then turn off the water by yourself?" They all raised their hands. "How many of you can go into your room, choose the clothes you want, and then get dressed yourself?" It was getting to be fun because they all thought, "I can do that." If you don't have the clothes you want, how many of you are capable of checking out what clothes you have the night before, and if the clothes you want are dirty, can do a load of your clothes in the washer and dryer? I can do that. How many of you have the power to make your own bed and get your room cleaned up without being asked or reminded? Everyone raised a hand. How many of you can be downstairs at 6:45 for our family time and breakfast? They all raised a hand. We went on through every single thing. In each case, they agreed. I have the power and capacity to do this. Then I said, okay, what we're going to do is write all of this down. We're going to create and agree to a plan for our mornings. They wrote down all the things they wanted to do and worked out a schedule. Our daughter, with whom we were having the greatest struggle, was the most excited. She wrote a schedule down to the very minute. We became their source of help on some things. There were a few guidelines. We decided on how and when they'd be accountable and what the consequences would be. The positive consequences were that everyone would be a lot happier in the morning, especially Mom. And we all know that a happy mom means a happy family. The negative consequence to not getting up on time and completing all their responsibilities on their own was that they would go to bed a half an hour earlier for a few days. This seemed fair, since lack of sleep usually makes it difficult to get up. Each child signed their agreement, ate a bowl of ice cream, and went off to bed. So we thought, okay, we'll see what happens. The next morning at 6 o'clock, my wife and I were lying in bed. We heard an alarm go off and the light click on in one of the kids' rooms. Before we knew it, our daughter, with whom we'd had the toughest time, ran to the shower, turned on the water, and got in. My wife and I smiled at each other in mild amazement. We had real hopes that it would work with her. But 15 minutes early? Within 15 or 20 minutes, she had done everything that usually took an hour and a half. And she even had time to get her piano practicing done. We had a great morning. The other kids did the same thing. After the kids were out the door, my wife said, "I am in heaven." But the real test is, will this continue? I can see them getting really excited about one morning, but will it go on? Well, it's been over a year now. Though we haven't always had quite the enthusiasm of that first morning, with only occasional exceptions, which were followed by earlier bedtimes for a few days, they've all gotten up and done everything on their own, especially our middle daughter. We've also found it helpful to come together every few months to evaluate how we're doing and to renew our commitment. It's been wonderful to see the children grow in their sense of, I can do this, I have the power. I am responsible. We try not to remind. It's been a profound lesson, and it totally changed the nature of our family life in the mornings. Close quote. You can see that the parents were initially trying to work from the mindset that says kids needed to change, but gradually came to the awareness that they, that is the parents, needed to change. The mindset was that kids needed reminding. You've got to check up, hover, and follow up. Maybe you've worked for someone like that. It's classic management or control thinking. But then the parents reflected on their children's worth and potential, particularly their potential. They knew the children had tremendous worth and they loved them unconditionally, but they had fallen into the typical trap of looking at their children through the lens of misbehavior. They had also not clearly communicated to the children their potential. They did this by asking some simple questions about whether the children believed, if they had the mind to, that they could do the basic things of getting up, doing their jobs, and getting ready to go to school. Because the children so identified emotionally with the parents, the communication took. Commitments were made and kept, potential was released, responsibility was taken, growth took place, mutual trust and confidence increased, and peace of mind and peace at home resulted. It's a beautiful, powerful example of empowerment, and a beautiful example of using a knowledge worker approach. Even though this is a simple little family problem, most families can identify with it. Sometimes in organizations, as well as families, people believe in the potential of others, but not in their worth. So they're not patient, persistent, long-suffering, trust-giving, and self-sacrificing. It's just not worth it to them. It becomes a cost-benefit analysis and they perhaps unwittingly conclude that the cost is too great. In fact, unless people have a sense of their own personal worth, they will not be able to consistently communicate the worth of other people. Let's review these four roles again. Modeling principle-centered trustworthy behavior inspires trust without talking about it. Pathfinding creates order without demanding it. Aligning nourishes both vision and empowerment without proclaiming them. And empowering is the fruit of the other three. It is the natural result of both personal and organizational trustworthiness, which enables people to identify and unleash their human potential. In other words, empowering enthrones self-control, self-management, and self-organizing. If this commissioning takes place, not just in organizational pathfinding, but at the team, project, task, or job level, where the basic needs of the people and the organization overlap, it taps into passion, energy, and drive. In short, voice. Passion is the fire, enthusiasm, and courage that an individual feels when he or she is doing something that he or she loves while accomplishing worthy ends, something that satisfies his or her deepest needs. Again, remember the roots of the word enthusiasm means God in you. Empowerment is exactly the same thing, only it's in the organizational context of employees doing work they love and doing it in such a way that meets their deepest needs and the essential needs of the organization. Their voices blend. In the book Now Discover Your Strengths, authors Marcus Buckingham and Donald O. Clifton report this key finding of the Gallup organization. Quote, "The great organization must not only accommodate the fact that each employee is different, it must capitalize on these differences." Close quote. The authors also report Gallup's research findings surrounding the following question, asked of 198,000 employees working in 7,939 business units within 36 companies. Quote, "At work, do you have the opportunity to do what you do best every day?" We then compared the response to the performance of the business units and discovered the following. When employees answered strongly agree to this question, they were 50% more likely to work in business units with lower employee turnover, 38% more likely to work in more productive business units, and 44% more likely to work in business units with higher customer satisfaction scores. And over time, those business units that increased the number of employees who strongly agreed saw company increase in productivity, customer loyalty, and employee retention. Close quote. Just think about your own personal life. What kind of job do you like? What kind of supervision? What taps into your deepest passion? What if you had a job that tapped into your passion and a job in which your leaders became your servants, where they existed to personally and systematically help you to do your job? What if structures and systems were supportive, helpful, and were geared toward enabling, identifying, and releasing your potential? What if you were continuously recognized and rewarded, and most importantly, felt the intrinsic satisfaction of contributing significantly to a cause you felt worthy of such heartfelt commitment? New heading, Empowering the Knowledge Worker. We live in an age of the knowledge worker, where intellectual capital is supreme. Product cost used to be 80% on materials and 20% on knowledge. Now it is split 70-30 the other way. Stuart Craner, in his book The Management Century, writes, "The information age places a premium on intellectual work. There is a growing realization that recruiting, retaining, and nurturing talented people is crucial to competitiveness." Close quote. Peter Drucker, in his book Managing for the Future, the 1990s and Beyond, writes, quote, "From now on, the key is knowledge. the world is not becoming labor-intensive, nor materials-intensive, nor energy-intensive, but knowledge-intensive. Close quote. Leadership is today's hottest topic. The new economy is based on knowledge work, and knowledge work is another word for people. Remember, 80% of value added to products and services today comes from knowledge work. It's a knowledge worker economy. Wealth creation has migrated from money and things to people. Our greatest financial investment is the knowledge worker. Just consider what has been invested in the knowledge workers in your organization through salary, benefits, possible stock options, and what it took to recruit and train them. That often translates into hundreds of thousands of dollars per year, per person. Quality knowledge work is so valuable that unleashing its potential offers organizations an extraordinary opportunity for value creation. Knowledge work leverages all of the other investments that an organization has already made. In fact, knowledge workers are the link to all other organizational investments. They provide focus, creativity, and leverage in utilizing those investments to better achieve the organization's objectives. Intellectual and social capital are key to leveraging and optimizing all other investments. And so it is absolutely critical that the empowerment of people, that is, aligning voices, is seen as the fruit of the other three roles of leadership: modeling, pathfinding, and aligning. Otherwise, you will see organizations talk and proclaim empowerment, but remain unable to walk their talk. They have no common vision, no discipline, and definitely no passion. Empowerment is not a new idea. In fact, during the 90s, it became quite a buzzword and movement in the field of management. But frankly, the empowerment movement has created a lot of cynicism and anger.